The New Zealand Business Podcast, brought to you by Guerrilla Technology, your strategic and proactive IT partner. Greetings and welcome along to the New Zealand Business Podcast. It's my pleasure today to introduce Craig Donaldson, who is the CEO at Care New Zealand. Welcome along, Craig.
Thanks, Paul. Great to be here.
Now, reading through your story, you've got a pretty incredible career spanning over 25 years, working around the world outside of New Zealand, quite a long time in Wall Street, and now you're back in New Zealand. So very keen to hear that story, but maybe we can start by hearing your background, where you grew up, and your formative years.
Oh, heck. Well, I'm just the boy from the shore, really. Grew up at North Shore, Morangi Bay. Actually went to Rangitoto College and, progressed all through that. And, I just loved kind of numbers and maths and all that. So I did the sort of do you go away thing or do you just go on to Auckland University as an extension of home? So I did that and did accounting. Didn't really want to be an accountant. I just thought there was lots of good jobs at the end of accounting. But I got to the end of university and I really liked trading and, all the hoopla that went with all the yelling and screaming of all that stuff. So, progressed, went to Bankers Trust and went on there after my Auckland University degree.
Wow. So how do you think that interest got sparked? How did you figure out what the opportunities were that were out there in the world that that might suit you?
I guess I tried to not do the sheep herd mentality thing. If you go on to, in those days anyway, to do accounting at Auckland University, you basically always went to the accounting firms, the top five, I think it was in those days, and they all came and recruited and all, and I think I signed up to Pricewaterhouse at the time. And sort of before I was due to start, I really had this bug to be a little bit different and to that was the day we always saw these traders on the news yelling and screaming and driving fast cars and all that. I thought, God, I want to be one of those. So I applied for all those roles and actually started there on, I started there as an accountant, but John Key was actually who's still a good friend of mine, actually, was the manager at the time. And so I started there as the accountant. I used to tapped him on the shoulder after the first week and said, Keezy, I took this accounting job, but I really want to be a trader. And he's like, great, well, go back and do your accounting job and we'll see. And I said to him, look, I'll tap you on the shoulder every Friday at 3 o'clock until you give me a trading job. And he's like, good, I'll see you at Friday at 3 then. And I kind of did every Friday for 6 months until someone had resigned and I got the job on the trading floor. So that was kind of my start into the world of finance.
Wow, so where were you based at that time then?
So BT Bankers Trust was a US-based firm, but it was in Queen Street. So we're on the Stock Exchange building, actually, in Queen Street. And so I started there for a couple of years, and we covered predominantly US firms that were doing things in this part of the world. So they were managing their interest rate risk or currency trading, and Kiwi dollar was a big thing at the time. So I was talking to sort of predominantly US clients, which is sort of where I sort of fade into the US piece.
Right. So tell me about that move.
Yeah, well, I guess I went to school, actually. I was 11 or 12, and my father did some work for the meat board at the time, and we moved to Sacramento in California as kids. So that kind of put the little bug of US, did a couple of years there. And then having worked for Bankers Trust, most of those US clients were, you could kind of stay in New Zealand and talk to the night desks of those US clients, or you could sort of put your big boy pants on and head off to New York and try and work in the New York day desk and talk to the US clients. That was sort of always the carrot, if you like. And after two or three years, I think I was 25, a job came up working in New York, and I thought I would give it a crack, and got moved off over there.
So how did that work out for you? What was the lifestyle like at that time? Must have been a pretty interesting period.
Yeah, it was mid 90s, 93, I think it was. My wife Vanessa you know, she was 23, I was 25, and we had no clues what we were really doing. And we did it for a couple of years, and I loved it, and she hated it, actually. And, you know, I was sort of off doing the market thing all day, every day, and poor Vanessa was at home. So we did it for a couple of years and then came back, actually. It was the heydays, you know. We kind of, we lived in New York City and lived the crazy life at night and did all the sort of the trading stuff through the days, and it was fun. But I guess it's a massive culture shock, right, coming out of Auckland, New Zealand, into New York. And then we came home and had kids, did 3 or 4 years back here, and then went back again in about 2000 and spent the next 15 years from there. So
right, so that initial period in New York, what did you find that you brought to the table into that environment from being a Kiwi landing in New York? You know, you must have been, you know, had some different, you know, talents and things compared to maybe the Americans. That, I mean, did you find some things that really helped you there?
Yeah, there's a couple of things there. I think the first thing, and I've since went on and hired a lot of New Zealanders out in that marketplace, and you hire lots of Americans and they think very inwardly, and it's all about, you know, America, and you can be the smartest Harvard grads and all that, but the Kiwis are very outward looking, and so I think I added value to the US desk, that all of a sudden you've got like an international citizen, that well, it's just not all about America. And so that's sort of one, so it's an outward-looking person. But I think secondly, I'll never forget, I started on the desk and the biggest client at the time was Julian Robertson. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's a Wall Street billionaire. He owns Cowrie Cliffs and Cape Kidnappers and a whole lot of things here in New Zealand.
Yes.
And you know, he's worth $5 or $6 billion at the time. And I was 25 years old, and I knew he was trading the Kiwi dollar big time. So I'd sat down on the desk in New York, and I'm like, I want to go and talk to Julian. And the guys on the desk in New York are like, dude, there's no way you can talk to Julian. He's like, you know, $5 billion guy. He's not going to talk to some sort of smarty pants that's come from New Zealand. And I said, oh, no, we can find his phone number, and managed to get through to Tiger Fund, which is who he is managing, and got to his PA. And she's like, oh, yeah, so what do you want? And I said, oh, I just landed off the boat from New Zealand, basically. I've got some fantastic ideas that I think Julian should be aware of, trading the New Zealand dollar, and some real sort of on the ground kind of stuff that the average New Yorker couldn't give him flavour of, and I think he should hear these ideas. And straight away I got patched through to Julian, and well, of course all the guys on the desk in New York were all listening into the phone call, so it was all very daunting. But Julian basically said, that's really cool, hey Craig, you know, how about you come and see me, we'll have breakfast in the morning, we'll have a decent chat about it. And I did, and he became a great friend and my best client for life, sort of thing. And it's only because I think we're not into that whole class system so much, or because I didn't go to Harvard, you kind of like, we're Kiwi boys and girls and we can talk to anyone, and if you think you've got a good idea, we're prepared to have a crack. And I guess that's why they like, why Kiwis do quite well around the world.
That's great. That's a great story. And you're not the first person to share, you know, something with that, you know, I guess with a similar message and a similar outcome. So I guess there is something in it that's just part of how we are. So going back in 2000, what did it look like for you at that time after spending a bit of time here and having your family?
Yeah, I think we went back a little bit smarter second time. We had a couple of kids at that point, and since had a third over there. I guess I still had that bug to be in the US, and that was the big time. We lived out in the suburbs and had more of a way, kind of typical Kiwi life, you know, house and car and all that good stuff. With kids, it's always a bit easier for the wives because they can do the school run, and that sort of feels a bit more like home. And, you know, Dad was at work all the time, but that was happening in New Zealand anyway. So that was a way better fit. I guess it was hard to get back in their marketplace. You know, it was a hustle. I think that there's a Kiwi story in there too. My story around that time was actually John Key that helped me with that. He basically said, if you want to go into that US marketplace, basically find someone in New York that goes on vacation for for 2 weeks and go and sit in his chair for a few weeks and do that guy's job. And at the end of the 2 weeks, you know, talk to the boss and basically tell him why he should have the boy from New Zealand again versus... So I did exactly that. I went to New York for a couple of weeks. The guy that I sort of covered for was on vacation, loved his clients. At the end of the 2 weeks, I kind of wrote a business plan for a couple of pages to show the boss to say, this is why you should employ me and why I can do a better job than the guy that was on vacation. And got on the plane back home. By the time I landed on Monday morning, the sort of the email had come through to say, I like the business plan. You start next week, kind of thing. And so that was how the second stint happened, and we're there for 15 years.
Wow, that's a pretty valuable tip, isn't it?
I think you sort of have case. To be, and I think it was a bit of a setup by Keezy, actually. I think he'd spoke to the boss, and yeah, the whole okay. thing was actually already probably half cast. But anyway, I think you have to have your plans and have your vision, and it's a subtle game, I think, between being too cocky, but having enough sort of back yourself, give it a go kind of thing. And I think New Zealand firms are pretty good at that generally. You know, it's kind of like that whole number 8 why we can have a go. I don't think we're quite as match fit as we think we are, and the world's moving pretty quick right now, and I think we can touch on that a bit later on the Kia stuff, but I think we do ourselves a bit disservice by kind of winging it probably a bit too much. But it worked out at the time for me.
So had you done a lot of preparation for that role? How did you make sure that in that 2 week window that you really delivered and you were able to deliver a great plan at the end of it? I'm sure you didn't wing that.
Yeah, I covered those clients. They were US clients that were covered by the person who was on vacation on the day, and I covered them at night, so I knew the clients very well. And I'd sort of got into those clients to say, I'm coming for a couple of weeks, and by the way, I'm sort of doing this with this in mind. And so I sort of got the clients on side. And, yeah, and I think you just, there's that Kiwi sort of thing where you get on the desk and you fit in well and you befriend the others around you. And I think that works out still today, actually.
That's great. Now, what was that role that you did at that stage?
So I was in the currency trading business. We basically helped big hedge funds and big institutional managers that were really punting on global currencies at the time, and still do. And yeah, so I was sort of talking to them, advising them, helping them do those transactions. Some of them are, you know, billions of dollars and they take weeks to do, and it's kind of fun, but it's sort of just, you know, it's an advisory kind of business, but it just happens to be, and it's got more sophisticated over the years around options and different sort of financial market products. But at the end of the day, it's a sales job. You know, it's a relationship-based sales job.
So when you say that, how important is relationship in the work that you've done over the years? How important is that versus, you obviously had to have some real smarts about you and an ability to communicate very well.
Yeah.
But how important was it to establish and build up those relationships?
Yeah, I think I, you know, having done, you know, 25 years, I've been home for 4 or 5 now, people always look back and say, yeah, if you could sum up one thing from your experience in the US or in Wall Street, what would it be? And I always come back to, it's the power of relationships, and how far they can take you. And I think it's, you know, you can be, it doesn't really matter what, you know, school you went to or what grades you got or how academic you think you are, or it's really about how connected you are and how well you can form relationships with people who ultimately succeed. And so for me, that's everything, right? And I try and look at all businesses and all careers now through very much that kind of relationship lens. You know, it's the old cliche, you know, it's not what you know, it's who you know. It's just so true. And I think if we look back on all those little successful things that we have in life, why did that happen? Oh, it's because, you know, kind of got to know Johnny and Johnny looked after me and we did it together. And it's not because it was your idea was that unique or that different.
Yeah, I get what you're saying, but I think you're not just average in terms of your smart. So I'm sure, that certainly comes into play as well, right? You've got to have some talent to offer, otherwise it's you're going to be fighting an uphill battle. You can't succeed in those positions unless you have to really know your stuff.
Yeah, I think these. I think on the academic stuff, everybody's smart in that space, right? It's even now graduates coming out of school. Everyone's got, you know, the top jobs that you want, they've all got A's. So you're just about kind of like, cool, you got A's, you know, got that, right? So what's the next layer down of things? And it's sort of, it's EQ and TQ, I call it, it's trust quotient. I quote that from the Trusted Advisor book. And it's like people are literally sitting on their interview process going, okay, do I like this guy? Do I want to sit next to him for 12 hours every day?
Yeah.
Do I kind of trust him? Is he going to be into it for me, or he's going to try and eat my chickens and take my job? Or so it just comes down to people-based stuff, because all that academic idea stuff is, and the same kind of applies, I think, in businesses today. I think I see that a lot coming back in New Zealand businesses. There's some great innovative entrepreneur business ideas that are amazing, and. But the inventor or the designer of those ideas will basically spend 5 years, you know, building the right widget, getting the right color, getting the innovation right, da, da, and then they'll go to sell it to their client, and the client's go, oh, I don't want that one. It's the wrong color, or they'll go, or their innovative business ideas, their funding for their businesses will start running out of money, and then they don't have relationships with their investors, or, and so at the end of the day, you can have the best idea or the best, you know, highest IQ, but if you don't have relationships with either your customer or your investor, best businesses fail,
and you're not going to get too far.
So you're sort of back, you're circling again back to kind of the power of relationships again, I think.
Yeah. So for you, in terms of building those relationship skills, were those things did that come to you sort of, you know, quite naturally as a teenager and as you, you know, moved through university into the workforce? Were you someone that leant on, you know, for instance, Dale Carnegie, who do their, training around, you know, EQ in particular? How did that work for you?
Yeah, a bit of everything. I think my father was a sort of a salesy kind of guy, and he used to work in the Mercedes dealership, and he would always tell me, you know, it's not what, you know, the guy that comes in the pinstripe suit, he'll basically never buy the Mercedes. The guy that comes in with the jandals and the, you know, the scruffy t-shirt, look out for him, because he'll be the one that'll probably buy. And, you know, so it's sort of like I've taken a lot of those tips on, I guess, as a kid growing up. I love Dale Carnegie. I used to have a box of books, Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People books. I had like 100 of them, and every graduate, and we used to employ 20, 30 grads a year that came out of Harvard, I'd kind of like, that's great, mate, you got that fancy A degree, that's fantastic, but here's your new Bible.
Yeah, brilliant.
And I'd give him the Dale Carnegie book, and I just think that's what, and we're not sort of doing investing enough in that relationship kind of game, so
That's interesting. With my technology services business, we work with Dale Carnegie Training. They're one of our clients. We've certainly used their services, and what they do is pretty good. So it's interesting. Sometimes the wisdom that we need and the things we need to learn aren't necessarily new things, because those books were, you know, quite a few decades book, right? old now, but so so relevant, ago. Right?
It's so remembering someone's birthday or their father was sick or whatever. And I think it's the same in Wall Street when things are really booting off, and you've got a massive transaction to do, or you're about to, you know, lose your job or lose $1 million, whatever it is. That you would ultimately deal with someone you trust, and then you have a relationship with, and that'll be the banker that they'll call. It won't be the guy with the smartest IQ or the, you know, the fanciest car. And it's, you know, that good old Dale Carnegie 100-year-old things are what looks after you.
Yeah, that's good. And so you took on, I guess, a number of roles while you were overseas. So, you know, walk us through, you know, what you moved into next. What companies did you work with?
Yeah, so unlike the Americans, when you're kind of there for life, the Kiwis and the Aussies, that you're there to maximise, you know, you'd as much income as you possibly can in a short period of time. And like all Kiwis, you sort of, oh, I'll go for a couple of years and then I'll come home and do something different. So that 2 years gets reassessed every year. You know, 15 years later, you're still there and you're still doing it. but I think I moved two or three times. I had 15 years at Deutsche, then I had a couple of years at Merrill Lynch, and then the last 8 years were at RBS. You kind of get headhunted as you go around. It's all very flattering, and you can move a couple of times before people get sort of sick of you, that you're just sort of this jumper guy. So I moved a couple of times. It's all, you know, basically for dollars at the end of the day, and I think you take those relationships and those companies that you have good rapport with on to the next firm. So I had those three firms, and you know, it worked out quite good. I predominantly stayed in currencies. I love the world of foreign exchange. I think it's really exciting, that, and I think it will never go away. You know, ultimately companies will keep trading offshore, and that's one of the biggest, fastest markets in the world, and it's kind of cool and exciting. So I predominantly stayed there. I had a few roles at RBS. We brought, we're the world's biggest balance sheet, actually. We brought the world's second biggest balance sheet, which was ABN. Forgotten the year, was it 08 or something? And then basically a meteorite hit Earth, and we had the financial crisis, and that whole thing basically imploded. So we inherited businesses that we didn't really need or want, so sort of became manager at that point. Typically in the Wall Street market, if you do okay in trading and sales, you sort of become manager and you get on and that. So I sort of progressed through the ranks a bit there, and ended up managing some emerging market businesses and what they call prime brokerage, which is pretty much along the same lines as sales and trading for currencies.
Mm. What were the challenges of working in those environments? What was the hardest thing for you? I mean, did you have pressures on the sort of hours you needed to work and, you know, on your family?
Yeah, I think I'll put it in two categories there. There's the up and the down, right? So when it's up, and it was up for 10, 15 years, when, you know, rising tides float all boats and everything's going great, I think that's about ego. Trying to manage the ego and not get ahead of your skis. You know, there's endless money to entertain clients, and you know, I think in the early days, you know, I watched that Wolf of Wall Street movie
yes.
A few years ago. My mother said to me, she said, it wasn't like that, was it?
What was your answer?
It kind of was, actually, but I never did the drugs. I wasn't into all that, but, you know, it was crazy, right? And, you know, we had deals where you'd make millions of dollars and your boss would say, take your client to Vegas and basically spend whatever you want to do more of those deals. And that was sort of why there was a correction, I think, ultimately in the financial markets, and that, you know, that's good. But I think, answering your question, the up thing, you know, I think that's about keeping, you know, gosh, it's about keeping your marriage on track. It's about staying kind of balanced and keeping your sort of head out of the clouds a bit. And New Zealanders are quite grounded with that, because ultimately we've always got that ripcord thing where it's kind of, it all gets a bit hard. And I'd go home some days and Vanessa would be like, or I'd be like, you know, it's the worst day ever. It's all just going to zero. And Vanessa would be like, oh, cool. Okay, cool. So let's just pack it up and we'll go home. We'll go on back to Morangi Bay and life's all good again. Right? Americans don't have that optionality, and Kiwis do. And that's sort of, so that allows us to stay balanced in the when it goes a bit haywire. In the negative zone where we were sort of trading off for the last 5 years, that's tough. That's, you know, that's hundreds of people laying off. That's really crappy conversations. And as painful as that is at the time, it's actually amazing from a manager, you know, it's one thing to write, as I say, it's, when it's all going good, it's quite manager career building stuff, that negative stuff, you know. And so I think that was kind of that was good learning. That was good learnings in those days as well. New Zealand probably is a little bit more insular in those cycles. You know, we don't tend to ship them in as quickly, and we certainly don't push them out as quickly. But in New York, it's kind of ruthless. You'll ship in 100 people on the good days, and you'll bang out 50 just because you had a bad day. You know, it's really, it can be good and bad.
So how did you cope with doing that? What was the, did you have a sort of a mechanism? Did you have to go through that a number of times in terms of, you know, letting
big groups of people will go, or were you in some way sort of, you know, insulated from the direct interactions with people on that? Because it's not easy having to impact people's lives in that way.
It's where I got quite conflicted, actually, on my whole relationship stuff. So my whole basis was, you know, that kind of, I think why New Zealanders do quite a lot of sure is because everyone's your mate. It's quite sort of, you know, they asked me the difference between New York and New Zealand. And in New York, basically, you know, everyone's, excuse the language, everyone's a dickhead until you prove yourself you're a good person. And when you're off there, because big cities, you have to sort of be kind of like, meh, you know, don't trust you yet. Give me 6 months and I'll get to trust you and sort of get you in and you know, you pull you in and then you're fine. In New Zealand, it's the other way around, right? So everyone's a good guy until you prove yourself you're a dickhead, and they'll actually probably kick you quite hard. But it's great that you have the benefit of openness, and they'll pull you in, and everyone's your mate, and it's all good stuff. So that's kind of refreshing, doing business in New Zealand versus the US. Where I go with that is, that everyone your mate thing is fantastic in building relationships. It's horrible when it comes to laying people off. And I sort of went through that cycle for a while where I really struggled, spent lots of time in HR actually, because I was sort of everyone's mate, and then I'm sort of, you know, having negative conversations and it's not going well. You know, unfortunately, I think in those big markets, you know, and I got told by a senior HR person that you have to envisage none of this good mate Kiwi bloke stuff, Craig. The way you have to manage your staff is that you have to envisage that they've got a brown paper bag on their head, and it doesn't matter whether they're male, female, black, white, whatever religion, what age, it doesn't matter. They do a job, they come at 7 and they go home at 5, and if they do great, you pay them amazing. If they do poorly, then they're gone, and that's actually how you had to manage to survive. And it was completely polar opposite to me, who I wanted to have them round for dinner on a Saturday night and get to know their kids, and I managed that way, and that was quite a tussle actually. I'm not sure I ever got it right, but yeah, that's sort of your upbringing a little bit, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think there's a huge amount to be said for valuing people and for learning how to treat people right. And I think, you know, in general here in New Zealand, we're hopefully pretty good at it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I would think most people would find it pretty hard to have to deal with the American way of doing things, where even, yeah, the legal structures around letting people go and so on are quite different to New Zealand, aren't they?
Yeah, it's... Yeah, I think we do need to... If we want to be New Zealand firms in the firm, we need to be match fit, and unfortunately we need to be match fit on our HR policies as well, right? And, you know, the US does have employment at will, and I was just in the US last couple of weeks, and Silicon Valley, and we visit Google and Facebook and all those firms, and they literally reassess their staff every couple of months. If this is working, great. If it's not, Johnny, this ain't working out. And you know, the New Zealand recruiting HR policies, it's a lot longer, isn't it? You know, you have to manage out, and it's 6-12 months sort of stuff, and it's, and yeah, I don't know what the right answer is. That's very human, and it's all good. It probably makes us a little bit less competitive, having to compete with that.
I guess I'm kind of curious, in that environment, how there's some downsides of it, obviously, and people aren't, you know, 100% sure where they're going to be in the future. But what are the positives that you see that come out of come out of that way of operation,
the US
model, or is there none?
Oh, there's out of the US style. Yeah, yeah, there's a lot of positives for that for sure.
Yeah,
it's you know, a lot of it's around ambition, I think.
Mm.
You know, New Zealand ambition, and we had this with Facebook last week. You know, we were talking to the Kiwi actually, who is in Mark Zuckerberg's management team, and his point is Kiwis aren't ambitious enough. You know, ambition in New Zealand is basically what is it, the three B's, right? The beach house, the boat, and the BMW, right?
That's right.
And you get those three, you've nailed it. That's ambition pinnacle, yeah? If you ask Mark Zuckerberg what ambition is, it's to change the world. And it's not the three B's. It's literally, I'm going to create, you know, $100 billion company and I'm going to change the world. And he's got 19,000 employees on that floor in Silicon Valley, and they're all there to change the world. And they are doing things that absolutely blow your socks off. And there's some cool Kiwis in there helping him do it. And, you know, that level of, I guess if you're not working out and it's not, you're not there to change the world and it's not fitting out, then you know that yourself. So you've tried to change the world and it hasn't worked, so you go and find somewhere else to do it. So it's just sort of, it's part of the, you sort of know if it's not for you and you move on. I guess it sort of becomes self-policing a bit.
Yeah, it seems a little bit like the sort of fail fast sort of, you know, business ethos is, you know, bringing that into people's careers. Yes. And working out, well, hey, look, I don't fit in this environment, so, yeah, you know, I need to move on, and you either work it out for yourself or in the US you're going to get bumped so that you learn the lesson anyway. And we do sometimes have that challenge here in New Zealand where people end up in roles that really they're probably, you know, they're not enjoying, not excelling at, and they would maybe be better off in another role.
Yeah.
But it can take us a long time sometimes to discover where we should be as individuals, right?
That fail fast thing's interesting, right? So in the US, they just about won't hire people unless you had a couple of failures. And it's totally okay to fail, or go bankrupt. It's totally okay for them to have a few jobs and not work out. In New Zealand, if you've had a couple of failures, like, you're not for me. You've had a, you know, banks don't like you. It all just sort of goes a bit. So there's just quite a different mindset, I guess, on what failure and agility really is.
Well, it's interesting you should raise that because, you know, I think, you know, across the people I've hired over the years, some of the best people are, you know, people that, yeah, probably other businesses would look at and think that, look, they're on the scrap heap. They haven't, you know, maybe haven't done very well in everything they've done. They maybe reinvented themselves a bit and, you know, they're still young. But, you know, if you can figure it out, there's some incredible people out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe had a trouble or two along the way, but when they're ready to get going, they're ready to get going. And
yeah, right.
You know, if you can hit them at the right time, then it's good for everyone.
Mm.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. So what was it that brought you back to New Zealand in the end?
Yeah, well, I guess there was a few things that kind of, I guess my 2 years, every 2 years thing started, I was running out of time on that. We had three kids, we have three kids. Phoebe, it was 16 at the time, now 20, been home for 4 years, and then two boys, 16, so 14 and 11. And I think that sort of that, there's so many Kiwis in America, offshore actually, these days that are in the same camp, right? And it's you know, you want your kids to grow up and experience a little bit of what Kiwi life was like. They're basically all little American kids, right? They've been there for 15 years and spoke fluent American. So I guess it certainly wasn't as much fun in terms of the Wall Street side of things. The comp levels were certainly not what they were. And I guess you're pushing your kid envelope for, you know, another couple of years. Phoebe would have been, it's all good, but I'm off to, you know, Harvard, thanks, knock yourselves out, back in New Zealand, I'm staying here. So you kind of know you're pushing up against those boundaries, and obviously they're harder to adjust the older they get. So we kind of made that conscious decision to move home and do something different, and it was fabulous. And we, you know, the transition's very tough, and it's very tough for kids, it's tough for everyone, but, you know, you work through that, and you rebuild your life back in New Zealand, and there's a lot of folks in that zone today.
Yeah, and it's a pretty nice country to come back to despite, you know, challenges of the big change.
Yeah.
So you're pretty happy you've made the move?
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so. It's interesting how I was lucky that I had spent 2 or 3 years in sort of how I got involved in Kia, actually, sort of building that runway home. You know, it's quite interesting with being involved in Kia and seeing lots of these amazing Kiwis that want to come back. they, you can't just sort of, okay, I'm done, I'm out, and I'm back in you, and like it's all a bit hard. Where if you'd sort of spend a few years sort of building that runway and getting your contacts, even just getting back into your family networks and old schoolmates and all that, that's, I was lucky enough to have done a bit of that, so it made that transition a lot sort of smoother and easier than probably it could have been.
Well, that, yeah, and I think that's smart, because I've certainly come across people who, yeah, maybe they haven't had that strategy around coming home and when they would come home and prepared. So they land on the ground in New Zealand and they've sort of a bit of thrown their hands in the air of, where do I fit in? I've got all this experience. There's, yeah. Hey, everybody. There maybe isn't somewhere to naturally fit in immediately, and it can take quite a long time to actually find that fit and to get reconnected. So it sounds like that would be something, you know, probably pretty important for others who are listening in that are not back in New Zealand yet, but are thinking about it, is to start preparing.
Yeah, it's building runway is massive, and you know, that's sort of where this, what this care thing's about, because there's lots of amazing skills that you build offshore that are absolutely relevant and useful for New Zealand firms, which is, you know, what we're connecting there. I think we also probably do ourselves a disservice on how we sell ourselves when we get home. You know, we've seen it time and time again where you rock up to, you know, an interview at, pick a name, you know, Fletcher Challenge or whoever it is, and the interviewer is like, so Craig, you know, so what did you do offshore? And you start telling these, you know, billion this and billion that and all these sort of high-flying stories, and basically the interviewer is just kind of like, oh, this dude's going to come back and basically eat my chickens and take my job, and there's no way I'm going to hire that guy or girl. And so they're just going to employ their mate from school down the road because that's way... And, you know, and that's sort of it's a shame that that's the way New Zealand firms think, but it's part of it's driven by the expat coming home as just doing a bit of a poor job at actually framing themselves up correctly. And I think if they came back and said, look, I've got some really cool skills in here, I see your business is going there, I think I could help you with that, and just sort of did it in a way more cooler way, I think that runway home would be a lot more successful.
Hmm. So tell me about your role at Care as CEO. How did that come about, and what is Care all about? Because I know, you know, we've talked about Care to a degree in the past on the podcast, and I'm sure it came up with Sir Stephen Tindall and maybe one or two others, but I'm not sure if everyone will be across what Care is all about.
So if I go back to my US sort of experience, the one thing that they do amazingly well is leveraging their alumni networks. You know, so you'll see a Harvard or Yale or Stanford grad, whatever, they would hardly ever go into a business meeting without finding another Harvard, Yale or Stanford grad that might be there, and they've leveraged them up and like, hey man, I'm coming for this interview or this business pitch, how does it really work there? And they just really kind of cultivated the, so they just about got a deal done before you rock up, right? And New Zealanders can absolutely do the same. And Kia is basically like a big alumni group, but at a national level. And there's, you know, 1.5 million Kiwis offshore. There's 500,000 that belong to Kia. There's what we call our world class, our high impact Kiwis. There's a few thousand of those that are in this sort of quite tight group. And they want to help New Zealand firms. And New Zealand firms heading offshore can basically link into this alumni group. And we did some analysis recently where I think 80% of the top firms offshore have a Kiwi somewhere in their top ranks. So I just don't think there should ever be a cold call in life. I just think we should take it out of the dictionary. And if you're going to head off overseas to pitch to, well, Facebook, I know for a fact there's about 25 Kiwis on Facebook and video and all the different areas. And if you don't find that person, connect with Care, figure out what's really going on before you have that meeting, yeah, you're not only sort of, is that a shame, the guy that you're pitching to against Harvard or Yale would have done that, so you're kind of screwed before you start.
Right.
Just about. So
yeah.
So that's what Kia is. It's about making sure there's no cold calls, and it's simply leveraging up the good old National Kiwi Alumni Network that really does exist.
That's great. Now, I've certainly drawn on networks, you know, overseas with establishing things on various trips, but I'm keen to understand what are the methods that people, you know, as of today, would utilise to hook in to the Kia network. I recall there being an app, and I think LinkedIn groups and so on. What does that look like now? What's the recommended path for people to get, you know, connected into Kia, into that group?
Yeah, so it's quite seamless. There's a website, Kia Connect. So you just Google Kia Connect, and basically it takes you to a form, and you can kind of fill out that to sort of say it's really about refining your business ask. You know, like, I want to take my avocado business to San Francisco, and I'd love to see a Kiwi that's done something similar that can help me. And we have people in the back end that look at those requests coming through. We do about 1,000 requests a year, or connections a year, and you know, at the end of the day, it's a free service funded by government to help New Zealand firms sort of get a leg up. And you know, it's as simple as that, really. It's an online kind of tool that, and then someone calls you and says, hey, here's three or four people that you might want to talk to in this area, if it's, you know, food and beverage or technology, whatever industry. We're doing more and more digital tools all the time, so you can start tracking it yourself, and seeing KiaNewZealand.com is a good website to go to sort of navigate some of the Kiwis that are offshore and how they could help.
That's great. And things like meetups and other sort of connections that are going on around the place, are you involved in facilitating that, or are those things that sort of just come, you know, somewhat naturally, you know, through LinkedIn and the like?
Yeah, so Kia sits sort of as the glue on a lot of the Kiwi groups around the world, and there's literally hundreds of them. We have someone in Shanghai and someone in London. We're about to employ someone in the US that sort of sits mostly in NZTE offices that can help, you know, so someone on the ground. We did about 40 events last year. A lot of it's around inspiring kind of speakers, you know, to say, here's a Kiwi, you know, that's gone good, made you know, sold his business to Google and gone on and changed the world. So we host events all around the world to kind of do those inspiring stories. But literally, we're quite connected to all these Kiwi groups, and they're everywhere. You know, from every city, you're basically in these Kiwi groups. So you can come through the Kia website and pretty well find them and connect up that way.
Mm. That's great. So with all the things that you've learned over the years, any particular bits of advice that you'd like to share with listeners that you've picked up along the way that you think be a general help, or you know, or a help to those who are looking at pushing out internationally and so on?
Well, I think it's really about that relationship piece. I think all roads do tend back there. I think, as I said earlier, there's kind of, we can focus so much on our product and not enough about our customer and how we go to sell it. Relationships are different things to different people, and I think, you know, the deeper you can go, and my US sort of time was spent me there, you know, I have this little acronym I call CALL, and I break it down. The first one is literally CALL. No one calls. Everyone sends an email or a text or smoke signals or whatever. It just doesn't work. Yeah, if you really have something beneficial to say or to sell, call the person. You know, I always say when it's your birthday and you get 100 texts or a whole lot of posts on Facebook, it's only your grandmother that calls you, you know, and that's the one that you remember at the end of the day, right? And so CALL is my first one. Second one is anticipate. I think the US is amazing at anticipating. You know, we go into, you know, lots of stories here around this stuff, but it's kind of, you know, you go to those cocktail parties where the CEO sort of rocks into the, you know, there might be 10 groups of 5 people, and the CEO rocks in and can basically touch, go into the first group and pop out, and into the second group and pop out, and kind of like work the room beautifully. That's anticipation. Most of those guys and women have spent hours in advance, seeing who's in the room, anticipating what they want, what you could get out of them, and just sort of being, you know, on the front foot of that. Leveraging is sort of the key stuff is really kind of, it's, I'm just going through my C-A-L-L. Leveraging those sort of positions is really successful. I think building building those deep I'll go back to the start. The call is, there's five parts of call. There's the call is one. The second C is actually connect.
Okay.
My little story there is I think we're in this false sense of security these days that we actually think that because we've, you know, have 1,000 people on LinkedIn or Facebook that we're actually connected, and you're not. You know, connecting in Walsh, when I first started, actually my boss hired a beach house out of the Hamptons, and he said basically over the summer I want you to go to that beach house, and it just happens to be next to your biggest client, and I want you to spend the summer getting to know his wife and his kids and really getting. And that's connecting, right? And I think if we're really passionate about relationships, you've got to get into that sort of level of thinking. So C for connecting, A for anticipating, L for leveraging. The key is sort of, you know, your alumni. And the last L is listen. You know, most salespeople, particularly blokes, we're all hopeless at this. It's just you do too much talking. And I think if you make your pitch and you... and then shut up, basically, and you hear what the client's got to say. And even if there's a really awkward silence for you know, feels like 5 minutes, it's probably 3 seconds. But if you just like don't fill those gaps, let those gaps and get some feedback back. And I think that's how you build relationships.
That's good. Great tips. Excellent. Anything else you think that we've left out that we should discuss?
I think back to your original point around IQ versus EQ, you know, it's EQ is big. It's that whole, do you trust people, are people really on your level? I think in a world where we're getting so digital and online and email and artificial intelligence and all that kind of, it's all amazing and it's all really good, but it's sort of, that is just the world, and the bit that makes it all different is how we relate to people. And you know, I have that saying, the Maori saying, hatangata, hatangata, hatangata. It's all about people. And I think whether it's at New Zealand board level, most of the issues are around, you know, beyond the product, and it's about people. And if it's a graduate coming out of school, you know, it's about, you know, how do you get a job and how do you relate to the interviewer, and what, it's about people. And the more you can kind of think deeply about that stuff, is it'll stand you in good stead. Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends. It's old school stuff, but it just won't go away.
It is, yeah. No, that's good advice. Well, excellent. Well, thank you, Craig, very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Great to have you on the New Zealand Business Podcast. Great to hear some of your story and some of your experiences, and to benefit from your learnings around the world.
Very good. Thank you.
That's great. Cheers.
The New Zealand Business Podcast, brought to you by Guerrilla Technology, your strategic and proactive IT partner.